Welcome to the HMO Success Podcast. I'm your host, Wendy Whittaker-Large, and I'm here to help you create a profitable HMO portfolio. Whether you're a brand new investor or you've been at it for a number of years, my podcast is here to help you make the most from your business, whether that is starting up, scaling, or systemizing. Please hit the subscribe button to make sure you never miss an episode. And if you've got an awe-inspiring project, an inspirational investing story, or a unique approach to HMOs, I'd love to hear from you. Have you decided that 2024 is the year when you need to start, scale, or systemize your HMO portfolio? Well, in that case, I've got great news for you, because I'm running two brand new HMO Discovery Days in person, one on the 27th of January in Birmingham and one on the 24th of February in London. I would love to see you there. For an investment of just £99 plus VAT, you'll get to learn my full five-step system, just as many other people have done before. And I'm going to be sharing stories of how they are now creating thousands of pounds extra income per month by applying what they've learned. The day is jam-packed, full of activities, exercises, and tools to enable you to go away immediately and start finding your very first deal. If you've already got HMOs and you now want to scale and systemize, there'll be tools to allow you to do that too. This is an event that you simply don't want to miss. Contact us now to reserve your place for either the 27th of January or the 24th of February. Whichever venue you choose, make sure you make 2024 an unforgettable year. Good afternoon. It's great to have you with me on the HMO Success Podcast. Of course, you might not be listening to this in the afternoon. You might be listening to this in the early morning or in the evening. Wherever you are, we're delighted to have you with us. And today I've got a very special guest because she is one of my dearest property friends. This particular individual started in property because she had a problem to solve. Now, how many of us can relate to that? All of us, I suspect. She was the head of a household with two young children, and her month and money were only just meeting. And isn't that a painful place to be? And she wanted to have more time with her family so that she could, rather than swapping her time for money, she could actually make her money work for her. And that was where property came in. So yes, today I have got the wonderful Susie Cole from The Good Property Company on the podcast. And I want to tell you that her story is inspirational because in 2011, which is when she started as a kitchen table startup, the first aim that she had was to source deals for investors, to work on JVs, flips, and then invest in property for herself once she'd made enough cash flow. And she also wanted financial freedom. In the first 4.5 years of being full-time in property, the Good Property Company sourced more than 200 properties, get that, 200, all in Bristol, with a value of over £45 million, at a purchase price of £30 million. How incredible. And after a while, she was asked by Wendy, who became her first student, to share her simple step-by-step systems. That's not the same Wendy as this one, a different Wendy. But nevertheless, Susie understands the importance of having a simple step-by-step system. And since then, thousands of students have benefited from her advice, helping them to source, to flip, to JV, to find investors, and to get to financial freedom. She's got a fantastic YouTube channel. If you haven't been there, check it out. Susie Cole, The Good Property Company, and she's got a super helpful website. And I know for myself, I have often downloaded the materials that Susie and her team have produced to help me on my property journey. There's lots and lots of resources there, including property checklists, packs, and she runs academies as well as other programs to help you not only be motivated to do this, but actually get out there and do it. So today I have the inimitable, the wonderful Susanna Cole.
Very nice to be here. But do you know why I needed the systems? because my brain is like a cat playing with a ball of wool. So I actually need to know what my simple step-by-step processes are. So I needed the systems for me, because otherwise I'd just go and complicate things and get all tangled up in that ball of wool. So I laid those systems out for me.
And you know, I can completely relate to that, Susie, because I'm not a system. People say to me, oh, you're very systematic, Wendy, you're really systematic. I'm not. I'm absolutely not. It was because I I'm the sort of person that could probably look in a cupboard and go, oh, I've got five ingredients, a bit like red peppers and green tomatoes, or is it the other way, green peppers and red tomatoes, and go, right, what am I going to cook? And I could make a recipe from scratch, but I can't repeat it.
Yeah.
And so if I was going to rinse and repeat, if I was going to create a scalable business, I needed to know how to make a cookie cutter out of what I'd done.
Agreed.
And unless you write down that recipe, you can't create those cookies, can you, repeatedly that work.
Yeah.
So that's really helpful. And I think, you know, that's, it's good to know that you did it really more out of discipline and necessity rather than a natural talent for systems.
Oh, there's no natural talent for systems. I just needed fluidity and simplicity. And when I was going quite fast, I needed to not wonder, you know, where the pepper was or where the tomato was. It's just there. Go.
Yeah. And that you had it in the cupboard that you can grab and use.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Now, what I'd like to do, Susie, and I have forewarned you about this, is
you have.
A slightly different start, a bit of a different format. I want to do some quick fire questions with you.
And help, people, this... help.
And the rules of this, you can only answer yes, no, or one word.
Okay.
And I've only got five questions. So we'll get these out of the way. But these are questions that I get asked all the time, although there's actually a couple that are specific for you in this that I've thrown in. But others of these questions are ones that my listeners have asked me, that my clients have asked me. And I thought, right, I'm not going to answer them. I'm going to ask Susie to answer them. So some of these are a little bit tough and we might want to go into them in more detail afterwards. But a quick fire. Are you ready, Susie?
Yep, let's go.
So let me ask you, number one, which is more important, health or wealth?
Health.
Do you prefer the UK or Spain in which to live?
Veer towards Spain, but that's because of the sun. Okay, Spain.
Okay. What would be the minimum return that you would wish to get on an HMO?
17% minimum, more like 23% ideally.
Is it true that someone needs to have a buy-to-let property before they can get into HMOs?
No.
Should you always have more than one exit strategy for any property that you're developing?
Yes, always.
Well done, you did it. So that was very good. I could see the dilemmas crossing your forehead
as
you were thinking about those questions.
I was told that they were going to be quite hard, by the way, folks.
Well, I think you did it exceptionally well, actually. And we might go into a little bit more depth with some of those. But I'd like to kind of pull back a little bit, Susie. And obviously, we've not really touched base for a while, quite a few months now on the podcast. And it's great to have you on because you are a wealth of knowledge and you have done so many different strategies in property. HMOs is one of them, but you've done lots and lots of other things as well. So I want to talk to you a bit about this year. 2024. I feel very hopeful actually about 2024, and I think there's lots to play for. But I'd like to understand where are you right now in terms of your thoughts about this year, and what are going to be your top three strategies this year?
Okay, well, mine. I'm super super optimistic about this year. I think it's a marvelous year to be heading into. For property developers, property investors, and landlords. We have to be mindful, we have to be careful in certain areas, of course, but thinking things like supply and demand, thinking about the changes that are coming ahead with Airbnb, so people need to be a bit more mindful of that, thinking about all the student lets that you and I are both very interested in doing. And then thinking about the fact that people maybe haven't moved house in the last few years, so flipping is going to be really fantastic as long as you can get the product right. So for me, it's an exciting year for property. Now, my top three strategies are actually slightly dependent on the circumstances of the last 3 years for me, because I had quite a serious health blip, which was a journey in of itself. So I'm just taking my time. Whereas if I didn't have that health blip, I would be diving in to 2024 and buying more property. This is the time that you buy when things are a little bit kind of flat, people are a little bit nervous. When they go left, you go right. You know, when they're feeling fear, you make sure you've got those five exit routes and you dive in and you make sure you're fully funded with good cash flow coming forward and you buy assets and you really do a great job on making sure you've got cash generating strategies at the same time. But for me, because I'm just coming out of a couple of years of bumpy health, I had 7 operations in the end, but I'm perfectly fine now. I am, number one, consolidating within the portfolio, so building up, building out, dividing, rents going up. Number two, efficiencies, so things like bringing in AI, bringing in more automation, things like with some of my student HMOs, rather than having people pay on a monthly basis, they're paying quarterly, 6 monthly or annually now. So all the different sort of practical efficiencies. And then the third one is actually rather than I'm a poacher turned gamekeeper or a gamekeeper turned, no, poacher turned gamekeeper. I'm now angel investing in people that I've known for years. And that is, I'm only not diving in to run renovation projects myself this year, purely because I'm just at that point of health recuperation. Otherwise, oh my Lord, I'd be filling my boots with them. 2025. Yes.
Could be a different year for you, yes. And I think it's interesting because when I first asked you that question, which is more important, health or wealth, I could see that, you know, you had to grapple with that a little bit because clearly both in the last few years have been incredibly important to you. Yes. And it is a very difficult question. And I having been what you've been through, clearly your health is now, well, it always has been a priority for you, but it's perhaps even more so now. And it's a salutary lesson, isn't it, when something like that happens to us.
Do you remember years ago, we spent the day together, you put on a really lovely day and you brought in a yoga teacher. And you were one of the pioneers of doing that way before other people were doing that. So you've always had that in mind. Yes. Yes. So
I suppose that's true.
Yeah. Yeah. Today. So guys, if you don't know, very briefly, without ever jumping into it, I had a multiple diagnoses of different cancers. They're all gone. I've had 7 operations and all the rest of it. So it was pretty tough, but let's not dwell on it. But it wasn't the easiest time, should we just say. But although I was surrounded by love. But so today, for example, later on, I'm going to go and do some hill sprints and I'm going to do yoga. That's non-negotiable. You know, some of the kind of parasympathetic work as well as some of the healthy, you know, get your heart pumping work. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic, Susie. I wish I lived closer and I'd come and join you.
Oh, you would just be like, no, overtaking me like mad. It'd be so much fun to watch. You could lap me and I would just be like, okay, see you at the top. Yes, yes. But I think the wealth underpinned the health because I ended up paying for a lot of the treatments privately and that was absolutely life-saving. So the wealth allowed me just at moment of diagnosis to stop work for pretty much 3 years. It allowed me 6-figure income during that time and it allowed me to pay for treatments that weren't necessarily being offered. I don't mean wacky alternative, I mean straightforward, necessary stuff and the forefront of science, you know, genome testing and all of that kind of scientific testing, which saved my life. So wealth actually gave me my health back. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So get into property.
So
get into
this
property.
Year-
Yes.
Absolutely. Because it is a pension, but it's also insurance for when things do go wrong, as they can do. If something was to cross your desk this year that would make you sit up and take notice and get excited.
Oh, yes.
And this might happen. We never know. Sometimes those kind of projects just suddenly appear from nowhere, don't they?
Yes, they
What would that be? That would make you think, oh, I really want to do this. What would that project look like? What would it be? What would it encompass?
Typically, just because of current circumstances, it would be something that I'd be doing as a JV. I'd probably be the funding partner rather than the delivery partner for this year. It would be with somebody that I'd known for years. So I've seen them go through the ups and downs and the difficulties. I've seen them pull themselves out of any difficulty through application and intelligence. And it's probably would be something to do with planning or say, you know, a large-ish building split in flats. Now, I'm not talking 180 flats. You know, let's leave that to the pension companies. But a building that you could potentially split into 4, 6, 8, or 10 flats, but no more than 10. So that beautiful sweet spot, which is too large for somebody that's thinking, oh, I want to buy myself a 2-bed flat to live in, where they're not going to buy 6 of them or 8 of them, but too small for the pension company. So the when they're sold collectively, the price concertinas down. So those tend to be quite juicy. And of course, you're looking at things like pubs and other commercial buildings, which, of course, these days people are working from home. So the demand has been a decrease. So it would be something where you add value or you are buying at serious discount because of the circumstances. And often that's a small block of flats.
Right. That's great. That gives us something to work on. A juicy deal like that. Anyone who's listening, oh, yes, got something like that for Susanna, please let her know.
But, you know, now, even when I needed the money, excuse my jumping in, but for somebody that's maybe starting out, even when I needed the money in the very early days, what I would do is I'd find, say, a house converted into 4 flats that was maybe on one title. And then what we'd do is we put 4 different investors as deal packaging clients. So each investor bought one of the flats. Our lawyer did all of the conveyancing for all of them and then split title at point of exchange. And we got paid 4 fees. And so it's really quite useful even doing it that way. You get some very juicy fees that way. And of course, your investors get amazingly discounted properties.
Yeah, that's clever. That's a very clever strategy. Yeah, very good. So, Susie, this one, something you touched on in when we were just starting was about AI, and you know in the early days you recognized the need to systemize. Nowadays there are lots and lots of tools out there that can help us. Can you share what you're using in your business and where you see the future of AI going with regard to property?
So I'm still at the early learning stage, let's be fair, because I technically came back to work a couple of weeks ago. So I'm with everybody else on the planet. I'm on ChatGPT 4.0 and learning its capabilities. So if we can think about probably, if you don't mind, more my property education business, because I'm applying it more there at the moment than my property business. But I think you can apply this rather than education if you're looking for investors. So I like a clean, calm life, you know. So I schedule a year's worth of social media in advance. And in order to do in a whole year. So if we let's translate that to you're a property investor and you're looking for investors. You know, you're hungry, you're dynamic, you're going to find discounted deals. You probably want to identify 3 or 4 strands of social media. So one would be credibility. Another one would be value. And then the third one would be investor acquisition. So you've got 3 themes. So write yourself a bunch of posts on credibility. Here's a deal I did. Here's a deal I wish I had done, but I didn't have an investor, but I would have done it. And here's the figures. And look, it sold for that 6 months later. I was correct. Or here's me going out and sourcing discounted deals. So credibility. I'm in the trenches. I'm doing the work. I'm starting to gather a track record. You could schedule that a year in advance. You know, once a week, that's 50 posts. So I'm using ChatGPT to assist with some of the copywriting because I can get a little bit stuck in weeds sometimes. You know, I forget about things like call to action. So a call to action for you if you're looking for an investor would be, you know, here's a photo of an old house I've gone on a viewing, or here's a house we did, our investor sold it, and here's all the evidence, and didn't they do a wonderful job, and PS, didn't we do a wonderful job getting them this discounted house in the first place? And then you could have a link to a free item or book a call with me. So you've got a call to action, and then your automation, things like Zapier or if this, then that, then adds that investor person or that potential investor lead into your CRM And then you would automatically send out a series of emails just to welcome them on board. And then you would book them in, say, for example, through Calendly. Now, you don't need a PA for that anymore. You don't need a secretarial pool anymore. This is all done through automation. And you could just schedule a year. You're relaxed. You know, we use Buffer. You can schedule your Instagram story as well as your or your other media. So that would be your credibility. Then you might put out value. Here are some tips I learned. And you might create 50 posts of those. And then you would put out kind of investor acquisition. Okay, here's a call to action to book a call with me if you're interested. And you'd have some pre-qualifying questions before they're able to get into your diary. Now, isn't that gorgeous if you did that a year in advance? So you're now...
Amazing.
And that's what we're doing, by the way. So if you look at all of my social media in this year, every single, if you like, themed will have been done by the end of January and scheduled. And then, of course, if something comes up or if just life is happy, I'll do lots of other bits and pieces. But I won't need to touch social media apart from answering all of that until 2025. So what that does for the person that wants to, say, deal package or source investors or source deals is it means it clears the diary for you to now go and get the stock and answer the inquiries from investors. So you're not troubled by having three different things on your mind. You know, you can go and be very clear.
And I think that's incredibly helpful. A few weeks ago, I did a podcast about creating a funnel for your property business.
Yes.
Because this, you're talking about, I suppose, drip feeding people through the funnel, you know, getting interest from people who are perhaps haven't have heard of you before. So that first awareness, then getting them to be interested and then getting them to take action. Yes. And effectively, by doing what you're doing, you are feeding your audience with value, with content, with inspiration, and those who are of the right position in terms of maybe what we might call an avatar, the right investor makeup, you're targeting those individuals as well to enable them to explore what it's like to invest with you.
Yes, because there's that whole 4-7-11, isn't it? They need to have seen you in four different places for 7 hours, and I forget what the 11 is, but it's that repetition. And the other thing I would suggest people do is run their investor days a year in advance. Now, if you've never done one before, you'll feel terrified. Don't worry, I was too. My first one was six people around my kitchen table. I worked with four of those six investors for years. And it was I was sort of shaking. I was so nervous before they all turned up. And I had a cup of tea and a plate of chocolate digestives. You know, I covered my nerves when they turned up, but I was terrified before they did. And again, you could schedule that on Eventbrite, and then the automation just links them back into your CRM system, and they get sent links to book into your diary pre and post. So what we're really doing here is, I'm not doing super sexy stuff yet because I'm still learning about it, but we're using very easy to use apps that are linking into our CRM system. And then you're identifying old school by talking to the people who you really want to work with. And it's as important to keep people out of your diary as in your diary. I know that sounds terribly rude, but when you are starting out in property, you're so busy. We were talking about this sweat equity at the beginning, that you can't afford to give enormous amounts of sweat equity that isn't going to give an outcome for your business as well as your investor. So that's why we always had a little barrier to joining our investor days. People had to pay some money. I mean, it was 20 quid, it was nothing. But if you don't want to pay 20 quid, you're definitely not going to be an investor. And if you don't want to answer 10 questions, you definitely can't get into my diary. You know, that kind of segmentation.
Yeah. Which is very, very powerful, again, because then you work with people who are right for you and you're right for them.
Yes.
And it's getting that match right, isn't it? Which is critical.
Yes. So I do think in the marketing that works, but I personally think I am a talker, as we know.
I love it. It's great.
I think on that one-to-one relationship, if you're going to work with investors, it's always one-to-one. So I've known you for a long time. I think the world of you. You know, we've had history. It's lovely. So I would trust you entirely because of that knowledge of who you are, of my experience with you. And I don't think you can get that from social media. You do eventually need to bring it to a one-to-one relationship.
Yeah, yeah, that's really helpful, Susanna. Let's talk about sweat equity. I love this phrase that you mentioned. And let's talk about leverage, because many people might look at you, people who have perhaps listened to the podcast, some of them will already have HMOs or have property. Some of them will have perhaps even worked with you or been one of your students, or some people might be very much starting off in their journey. And these are different levels in property, different stages. How do you see leverage working as a property investor?
I was mulling this over earlier, actually, because I had a really nice call with somebody who is at the beginning of her journey and has got, you know, no cash at all, literally, lentils in the cupboard kind of stuff for her family. And I cannot, and I'd love to be contradicted, see that at the beginning you can't remove sweat equity. Partly because of that 10,000 hours that Malcolm Gladwell made popular, that you do need to put the work in to have the expertise to be very good at what you do, to be skilled at what you do, to be more effective at what you do. So I do think the bottom layer, unfortunately, folks, is a bit of sweat equity. But as soon as you can, you want to leverage that up into processed systems so that you can rinse and repeat. So, for example, I started flipping one property at a time, ended up flipping 30 at the same time, or, you know, coming in, being renovated, being put on the market, being under offer. So at four different stages. So I wasn't renovating 30 at the same time. Some they'd finished the renovations, we're just waiting to be paid out for them. And that was simply scaling up. And that was because I then built a bit of a team. And I think there's been a real change. So I used to have a team in-house, and now all of my team are remote access-based, and I always look to see where I can automate before I actually delegate and outsource. So I do think you start with sweat equity, but you'd be making a huge mistake if you continued to paint the walls. You know, the minute you can pull yourself out of the day-to-day work and be the kind of conductor of the operations, then you're starting to leverage. And I do think that bringing in investors' money is very important as well for leveraging up.
So energy or sweat,
yep,
needs to be utilized at the beginning to, yep, get things going. And you might even argue that actually, as an entrepreneur running a business, a CEO of your business, whether it's you or you have a team of people or you've got an outsourced team, whether you've got one or 1,000 employees,
yep,
as a CEO, I think you always, to a certain degree, retain that role to provide leadership and energy.
Yes.
It might be a different form of energy. It may be more thoughtful, reflective energy, rather than at the beginning, it's a little bit more activity-based energy.
Yes.
Like you say, you're not going to be painting the walls, even if in your first flip, that's what you might have had to do.
That's right, which I certainly did, and you possibly did too.
Yes, I did. I did with my boys. We all,
yes,
my very first HMO, got a picture of us all painting one of the bedrooms.
And I think we move through, in the same way as a property investor, we move from the kind of, asset acquisition, asset pay down, and then asset buying with cash. Those are my three stages. I think we also move through that three stage of plan, do, review. That entrepreneurs. So at the beginning, before, if you're listening to this and you haven't started in property, you're fully in plan, and hopefully your plan is perfect. All of our plans were perfect. Then you move into do, where many of you are, and then you get into the imperfect bumpiness of just entrepreneurship and property and people and builders and, you know, market and buyers and sellers and investors and everything. And I think typically we as entrepreneurs, as smaller scale entrepreneurs, you know, chief execs of FTSE 100s, we miss the review stage. And so partly because of the health challenge that I had, which meant that I've got to just be very clear about immune systems and just, you know, switch on the parasympathetic, which means I'm not going to do my 16-hour days that I did once. I want to be quite intelligent about the review stage. So that's setting standards, setting targets, identifying why I did or my company did or didn't hit those targets, identifying the right people for the role. The tough bit is identifying the people who aren't right for the role and parting ways in a respectful manner and recruiting in the A-listers who are right for the role, or identifying technology that's right or wrong for the role. So it's about reviewing KPIs, key performance indicators. And I always had them, but it was always a bit of a kind of scrabble in on a Thursday afternoon to review them. Whereas now I run from the KPIs downwards, not the activity upwards. And I think that's important. And as a result, you become more efficient.
So you're leveraging your time by outsourcing your team. And of course, that effectively leverages your money as well, because it's often cheaper. You may tell me whether if you found that to be the case, Susie.
Yeah.
And then I suppose the second thing is, as you touched on, in terms of your investor journey, people take different paths through that. Some continue to leverage quite highly their property borrowing quite highly. And in other cases, people want to pay down that debt, and they want to, they'd rather own a handful of paid for assets by the time they're 60 are effectively, we'll perhaps touch on Section 24, but they're avoiding the whole issue of Section 24. But also they that's the point they want to be. Whereas others are continuing to leverage, and there's neither one that's right nor wrong in that situation. But it's about being perhaps mindful about where you want to be and how you're therefore going to get there.
So, are you an empire builder or are you a lifestyle? So, although I like to kind of 200 deals was very good fun to do. I'm actually fundamentally lifestyle. It's why I live in Barcelona and Bristol. And, this year I'm going to do 3 months in New York and 6 months in Barcelona and 3 months in Bristol. So that is lifestyle, even though I did 200 deals in 4.5 years or 217 in the end. Know who you are. And as a result, I've always been very keen on reducing down the loan to value of the properties and having assets paid off. And that stood me in great stead when I got hit by, the health difficulty and went, okay. And I said to the nurse, what happens if this is stage four? And she said, we stop treating you. I didn't actually stay with that department. I think that's a polite way of saying that. It was quite an interesting experience. And I thought, no way, buddy. So I sold 6 houses to have a very, very large wall chest in case I needed to pay for treatment anywhere in the world. And as it was, I just went to the Royal Marsden, which is the best cancer hospital in Europe. So but if I had leverage to the hilt, that might have been quite tricky. And I'm very glad I didn't. Yeah.
Yes, I think that's very, very wise. And I think that for anybody listening to you, your journey is one that has, if you like, you've had to face some of these questions. You've been made to face some of the questions, perhaps earlier than you would have done, but they've paid off massively for you because you've clarified what it is you're trying to achieve.
Yes.
You've been super clear about it, and you've then implemented your plan.
Yes. Yes. And very, very grateful. To be fair, very grateful that I wasn't sort of caught at the complete growth stage, because, of course, like everybody else, I was leveraging quite significantly. Whereas now I'm going to jump to Barcelona in 2 weeks' time, and my son and I are going to go skiing in Andorra. Very nice. Very nice. So yes, that's sweat equity. But the most important, I think, eventually is the doing. So every single week now in my diary, I have 2.5 hours of KPI analysis, key performance. So basically targets. Did we get to where we're supposed to get to? And if not, why not? So it's looking at the strategy. And once a month, I have a larger section, which is monthly analysis. And once a quarter, I have a larger section, which is quarterly analysis. And of course, I meet up with my accountant on a very regular basis as well. So it's more about analyzing in order to take more intelligent decisions to create greater wealth more efficiently.
That's all very powerful stuff, Susanna, and it's great to hear that you have that approach and that systematic review of your business. I suspect, though, even with all the good parts, you've got some headaches. Even Susie Cole has headaches.
Oh, where do we start?
Well, could you share three of them?
Yes.
But what, at your level, what headaches are you grappling with?
Okay, I'm going to be really frank, and I am not, this is not me sort of saving myself legally. I am not necessarily telling you guys I'm right about this, okay? So the Section 24, if you're new to property, very simply put, we used to be able to own property in our personal names and count the mortgage cost as a cost, because it is. And now we're only allowed to count a very small amount of that mortgage interest cost. So if you're starting out significantly, you're probably almost certainly going to be advised to put your properties in a limited company. However, a fairly large landlord like me has, I've only got like £1 million in a limited company. The rest of it, the huge majority of it, is in my personal name.
Mm-hmm. Because you started prior to 2014.
Correct. And I really went for it and built a very large, a sizable portfolio. Other people have got much bigger ones, a sizable, strong portfolio. And I looked at the Section 24 and I looked at the advice that people were giving, which was completely legal, that people would be able to move their properties over to the limited company and potentially crystallize the capital gains. And, you know, and I just thought, I'm not comfortable. Now, I'm not saying I'm right, and I'm very okay with people contacting me and saying, Suze, you're so wrong, and because of this. And it may well be I've bet on the wrong side. But I just remember myself as a young 22-year-old looking at, you know, in a fringed hippie skirt, looking at this lawyer who's trying to sell me an endowment mortgage, going, could you say that to me again? I really don't understand why you'd be giving me a mortgage that wasn't actually going to pay off the mortgage. Don't get it, Buster. Obviously, you know, thinking I must be wrong. So I may well have made the wrong bet, okay? But I'm not going to incorporate my portfolio, unlike most large landlords. And the reason is that you may well be able to crystallize some of the, effectively, the tax due within the shares. But what if the government changes the rules and pulls the string on the jumper and says, let's unravel that? You know, for me, it's millions. And I don't ever, I did property for freedom. So at no point am I going to take a step across, which will cost me a lot of money cash wise anyway, but that's not such a big deal, and put myself in a position where I've cornered myself and my opponent, if we want to call them an opponent, is HMRC or the government. And they pull one piece of wool and they unravel the jumper. Now, I am truly okay with being wrong on this, and this decision costed me a lot more money, but it's also a pain in the neck because I'm paying so much more tax right now than if I'd done it. Yes.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, just don't get me going down on that whole.
Oh, yes.
It's horrendous. It's horrendous. And, and I can completely relate to it. The pain is beyond belief. And is it any wonder that landlords are getting out of the market and selling?
Of course. Of course. And then the other fact is rents are going up because, you know, if people, I mean, even with paying the tax, I'm still nicely profitable. But other people, if they're a little bit higher geared, would be loss making at that point. Either the rent goes up or they sell the property. So, so that's a real pain. And so having chosen to corner myself in my own corner where I'm my own opponent, I only have one option, which is to pay properties down.
Yes. So that's one of your headaches, Section 24.
Yes.
What about the other two?
I think okay. The other one is just classic. It's building team, building team and reminding myself and keeping standards high. So at the moment I've relaunched my property business because I was very gentle for the last 3 years, building the team. Everybody's working remotely. We're doing daily trainings twice a day, and I'm observing performance the entire time because I only want to keep A-listers. I want to have a team of fantastic A-listers. And there is always that you have to be very clear about your goals, because the hardest thing in the world is to say to somebody, I'm sorry, we're not a fit. Nobody enjoys that moment, but it is not. I'm not going to keep the pain of somebody having somebody who isn't quite delivering at the level I need them to deliver to, as opposed to not having a business that isn't delivering to level it's delivering to, or looking after the people I want to be looking after. So it's just that classic of when the rubber hits the road, you know, where you have to make some decisions and say, superhuman being, not sure your performance is quite right for my business. You know, wish you well, good luck, respect. Never fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's tough. It's tough to do that, but you've got to prune all the time to get the best fruit.
Yes, you do. I agree. And this came to me years ago when I was pruning roses, and I was like, oh, I see. Got it. So I think it just needs to be done with respect. And then the third one is probably managing myself. I am a cat with a ball of wool. I am super excited to be back into property. And I just need to be mindful that I do the yoga, I do the hill sprints. I had a friend come around last night. A friend texted me to say, hey, I'm just going to go, do you want to come and meet up with me? Just be mindful that I bring all the other beautiful, joyful things into my life. So, which is why I'm booking all my travel and my skiing with my son and things like that, because I can get excited about something and disappear down a rabbit hole. So it's just keeping joy to the open world and not being that kind of classic entrepreneur. And if anyone else is getting into property, you will discover it is, I would call it addictive.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
So it's keeping a lid in yourself.
True.
Yes. Yes. Do you struggle with that in any way?
No, of course not. Oh. No, I've got a perfect lifestyle. absolutely. I believe it's very important for us as entrepreneurs and as human beings to grow. I think I like the natural world has given us, particularly in the Northwest. This isn't necessarily true in other parts of the world. We have to, we can't create a pattern that is true for the whole world. But in where we live in the UK, we have spring, summer, autumn and winter. We have seasons, and the natural world goes through a cycle every year of shedding leaves, getting cold as it is today, stopping growth and retreating in on itself and having a rest period, animals go into hibernation and so on. And then spring comes, and spring is where there's new opportunities, there's new growth, there's new hope, there's things happening, there's new relationships burgeoning and blossoming. Summer is the time to then make, you've perhaps started to sow your seeds, you're sowing more, you're getting out there, and then you start to farm those a little bit later. And that whole process, I think, to me, mentally, is a very good rhythm for my business.
Yes.
And keeping that rhythm is vital. But I do tend to want to be in summer all the time.
Of course.
You
just want to drive the tractor
Exactly.
Yes.
I want to be farming all the time.
Yes.
And so therefore, for me, it's very hard to realize that actually I'm still playing on the pitch. I'm mixing metaphors here, but I'm still playing on the pitch even when it's winter.
Yes.
But it's a different kind of activity.
Yes.
And so I think for me, one of the things I've learned is that my own property business goes through cycles and seasons, and recognizing which cycle and season I'm in and responding appropriately. And also sometimes being able to predict what the next part of my property sort of season we're going into, because some of that puts me out of my comfort zone. But actually, when I'm not in my comfort zone, I'm growing. And therefore, I need to be out of my comfort zone on a fairly regular basis. So I think for me, there's lots of times when I'm enjoying the fruit of my labor. I'm in autumn and I'm loving it. Last year, I think we had 7 holidays. We traveled literally around the world. We went to Australia for 3 weeks, Singapore. I had lots and lots of holidays abroad, and it was amazing. A great year for travel. And this year, again, we've got some big trips planned once Tom has done his GCSEs, because he's in year 11 now. And these are all the fruits of my labor. But I also don't want to become complacent. And I want to continue to grow as a person. I think my business is almost the best vehicle to allow me to do that. So, those are some of the ways that I see it really in my business. It's about growth, but it's also about recognizing that rhythm that's so valuable as well. So that you don't get burnt out and you carry on being productive.
Agreed. And I think one of the best ways of that growth is being in rooms or being in informal masterminds or being in with one-to-one or small collection of people where you're kind of the dumbest one in the room or you're the least experienced in the room, where you're thinking, I'm not sure if I quite fit in here. I'll just keep my mouth quiet and listen, this is fabulous. And you're ever so slightly on your toes uncomfortable. That's thrilling, I find, because it's so inspiring and so interesting. And of course, actually, the reality is, with the classic imposter syndrome, you absolutely do belong in that room. But So that's going to be, I'm going to be very mindful of that this year and put myself into rooms where I am the junior party, you know, and that's going to be quite thrilling.
Now, on that point, I'd like to ask you a little bit about joint ventures. Yes. I know that in the past you have utilized the funding from other people to grow your portfolio, as of course many of us have done. And I'm sure that some of those joint venture partners have probably been more experienced than you. You've learned as much from them as they've gained from you. There will be people today listening and thinking, you know, I'd love to grow the size of portfolio that Susie Cole's got. But I'd like to drill into that a little bit more in terms of people and investors. Share some of your wisdom, Suze, about how you've gone about raising finance for investors and what you might look for. And then you can perhaps share how it's kind of flipped now in your life, which is again a new avenue for you.
Yes. I've been investing in others for about 18 months now. Whereas prior to that, I mean, I've paid off my investors, all of them. So first off, I had rules, which was, if this goes wrong, I need to only ever borrow the amount of money that I could then spend the next 20 years paying off. So I, depressing thought, eh, guys? Because if I borrow the money, realistically, I've got to pay it back, haven't I? You know, and so I only ever decided to borrow £1 million maximum, thinking, oh, blimey, I could work the rest of my life and pay this off. It wouldn't be fun, but, you know, I potentially could. So I always stopped at that point, so I didn't go higher. So I didn't ever fall over, you know, if something folded and you just watch this, you know, house of cards going down. And then I just did that. It's a system process, which is 5 to 9 conversations, meetings, coffees. These days it would be Zoom videos, meetups. So they were intentional appointments, not, oh gosh, how lovely to see you at this property event. No, that doesn't count because neither one of you showed a commitment. So it was a bit like dating, but in a kind of completely platonic manner. You know, did we both agree to be at this place, either digitally or physically, at this time in order to meet each other, in order to have a discussion about what we might consider doing or start exploring to consider doing? So I never kind of jumped early with an investor. I was always like, let me just check them out. Let them check me out. Let's take our time. I often wanted to then put them in a small group, say a group of 15. So I would call that an investor day, so they could see other people. It helped them understand they had a tiny bit of competition, which was always very useful for you. And it also gives them social proof. And also for you, the person looking for the money, it means that you're going to answer 15 people's questions in a couple of hours rather than one person. So it's also very time efficient. But I was very old school. It was ultimately a one-on-one relationship, and I would only ever work with people that I felt I intrinsically trusted, that my best investors, we agreed deals on a handshake, but always followed up with legals. I mean, I'm investing in somebody who's very dear to me right now, also a very talented property investor, but everything's legal, you know, and I certainly did a quick scan and check of all the person's assets, just in case they went horribly wrong. So even with people that I fully trust and have known for, you know, decade, I've still got legal documentation. So I'm looking at the character and the personality, and and I always wanted to show people the character and personality that I assumed if it went wrong, I would do everything I possibly could to put it right. And I think people trust you at that point generally.
Yeah. Okay. That's some incredibly useful advice. I think it's very much got to be relationship based, backing that up with legals and with paperwork. So you have an audit trail and you then have explicit agreements that you both sign up to.
And you also, before the final agreement is signed, you also have a half hour conversation, which is titled, "What if it goes wrong?" So that you have forewarned your investor all the horrors that could happen in property. So the builder could go bust, the builder could run off, the builder could break a leg. God forbid, let's not hope that. The roof could be worse than we think when we get into it. We could discover dry rot, we could discover other types of rot. The windows, they may have just put putty on them, and you know, underneath it, we may be discovering, you know. So here are all the things that in our experience have occasionally gone wrong. Let's hope that nothing goes wrong on this renovation, but let's discuss everything. The market could drop. We might not find a buyer. The buyer might pull out at the last minute, et cetera, et cetera. So discuss worst case scenario so that you can see how they respond. But also it means that if and occasionally in one of your projects something goes wrong, you've already discussed the theory of that happening. So they're disappointed. But you said, remember, we talked about this. This is what we're going to do. And never go to your investor if something's gone wrong and say, I don't know what to do. You figure it out before you get on the phone. You may well not have slept the night before. I definitely had nights like that. But you figured out a solution before you have a conversation with them. So here's what's gone wrong. Here is my solution proposal 1, 2, and 3. I vote for 1. Let's discuss all 3 so that we can see where your agreement lies. And maybe we have 2 calls about this. So you don't need to make a decision today. We'll have another call in 2 days' time. I'll send you over an email as well, and you can evaluate my thinking, and then we make a decision collectively as an investing team. So you're not putting them on the spot. You're treating them intelligently, but you're also in property, so things go wrong.
Yes, yes, quite. And in terms of how you would ensure that that investor was right for you, you've talked a bit about, you know, the trust, the build up, the relationship development. In terms of the position of that investor, how, to what degree do you do, or have you done due diligence on that individual?
Oh, yes. Well, I used to train in a gym, shall we say, that had a tiny bit of a reputation, and quite a lot of the lads, because I used to do a lot of heavy lifting, quite a lot of the lads, shall we say, used to be in Her Majesty's biggest HMO.
Okay. Yeah. HMP, not all. Not HMO.
And there was an awful lot of gold teeth going on. And every now and again, they'd be like, Susie, let me invest in you. I'm like, honey, I know where your money's come from. No way, you know? So, I was extremely mindful of things like money laundering checks, which I would always get my lawyer to do on my behalf. Because also, it's quite nice for the investor if the money is running into the lawyer's account and then into yours. Been seen by a lawyer. The lawyer's doing the money laundering checks. You're more sure that the money laundering has been done correctly, and then it's been deposited into you. But also for your investor, they're like, okay, somebody's seen it. So she can't run away with it because the lawyer knows. You would do for joint ventures, obviously PS 13.3, they need to be a high net worth, sophisticated investor. For me, it was always high net worth. I needed to see the assets. I needed to see the ownership of the assets. I needed to see the latest mortgage statement to understand the equity, depending on what the assets were. So, you know, every now and again, we'd have, you know, a chap who owned properties with his sister. Well, what's the share split? Because it might be that technically there's enough asset there for you to be considered high net worth, but I need to know that you own it 50-50 and there's enough for you to be technically. So, yeah, and then so we actually had both quantitative and qualitative. And we actually filled out forms that we just kept in our Google Drive. We didn't share them with the investor. So we had all the technical forms, the money laundering and the kind of, you know, PS 13.3 variable opportunity stuff. But then we also had the form, is this suitable for them? What is their current situation? Why do I think this deal is correct for their situation? So, for example, a very sad case a very long time ago, somebody who used to run a property event. I'm going to be honest, he was really annoyed with me because I met his dad and he said, my dad would love to work with you. And his dad had been a super successful businessman, but his wife had died 9 months earlier. And I loved the guy. He was quite elderly at the time, but he was magnificent. You know, what an entrepreneur. I mean, I just was buzzing to be in his space and just thought, oh my God, I would love to work with you. You took a tiny little business, you made it national. You are stunning. But his wife had died. And I do not think that it was appropriate to take money from somebody in the first year of grieving, because you could actually be accused of, you know, sort of being untoward towards somebody who's in a vulnerable position. So it was things like, what's their personal circumstances, and does that enable them to make correct decisions at this point? Now, his son was furious with me, and I really understood that, because he wanted his dad distracted. But that, unfortunately, was the right choice to make sure I wasn't taking advantage of somebody's grief, you know? Mm. So it was a real shame.
The ethical side, yes, quite. But Susie, it shows the ethical side of doing this has not only meant that you have got an untarnished reputation, you can sleep at night.
Yeah.
Because you know your conscience is clear as well. And
yes.
And I think that's incredibly important too. That using other people's money, you can become very high on it. It's like a drug. When you know that you've got a tap there, that you can go out and buy property because somebody else has given you X amount of funds to be able to do that with, whether that's through a joint venture or they're lending the money to you, you know, you might be giving that to on an interest repayment basis, and they're lending the capital. You know, it's an incredibly wonderful and amazing feeling. When it first happens, you kind of almost can't believe it. But I found every single investor I've worked with, I've always got equally excited about. But there's a danger in that too, because it can set you off on a little bit of an ego trip.
Yep.
And you've got to remain very feet on the ground, practical, and as you say, accountable to that investor.
Yeah.
Keep feeding back to the investor what's happening. And, you know, you can come down with a bump if you're not careful, if you haven't, you know, sort of paved the way.
Yes, yes. And when they lent me money directly, we didn't have huge amounts of communication. We did, but not on a super regular basis, because as long as you set up a standing order, pay the interest, and then pay the capital back at the end, job done. But when you're doing joint ventures, they're much more involved. And so I would literally have half-hour meetings in the diary every single week. So Thursday was my investor day, and it was back-to-back from 8 a.m. onwards, because I had multiple projects going on. And then again, you'd use tech, you know, you'd upload all the information in the Dropbox, photos, videos, so that they could see all of that before they came on the call with you.
So it must be rather nice for you to be, yes, sort of gamekeeper turned poacher.
Yes.
And maybe poacher turned gamekeeper.
Yes, yes. And I do want to encourage people. I don't want to say go get loads of money out there. But honestly, guys, it's actually very easy to raise finance. It always has been. And because you invest in the relationships first. So I started out being an angel investor because somebody I know who's very talented in property just had a hashtag save my bacon. Now, not save my bacon in any terms of bankruptcy, just save my cash flow bacon for a week or two. And guys, this is how easy it is to do property. I think the request was, might you, you know, lend me, you know, it's under 50 grand. Yeah, no problem. When do you need it? Send over the documents, sign it unsignable. Okay, in the bank. Probably an hour between one and the other. So that's how easy it is when the relationship is strong. And so I now, having moved from that hashtag save a temporary cash flow bacon job, which was just for a small number of weeks, I now say, right, next year I'd like to work with you on this project. What do you want to propose? Here's the budget. And then as long as the proposal, so it's all about trusting the person and their capability. And then it's just, which project do we do that fits with the budget that you're willing to supply?
So that is actually a very nice way of testing the water, isn't it? By lending somebody a small amount of money first. And again, sometimes I say to my mentees, try borrowing a small amount of money from somebody before you start to ask for large quantities, because if they can see you're trustworthy in small matters, you'll be trustworthy in large matters.
Yes.
And
yes.
The other thing is, borrowing money on that individual basis, two lots or three lots of £25,000 is probably easier to find than one lot of £75,000. So if you're looking to, let's say, fund a development or refurb project, you might find three people who've got £25,000 sitting in their bank, but to find one person who's got £75,000 in the bank can be harder.
It can be, but I was always very mindful when I was borrowing myself of being so careful of collective investment schemes, so not mixing people's monies together. And I agree with you, there are lots more people, 25 grand, that want to lend the money. But the most productive investor relationship is the one where they've got six figures, serious six figures, not small six figures, because then it's a, so my when I was growing my own portfolio, my biggest investor, he had 5 million quid to invest, right? He told me very clearly, and he invested it in five strands, and he anticipated two would be duds, two would be kind of average, and one would be a huge cracker, you know. And that was, when he says duds, he was still going to make money on them, but not much, you know. That was his anticipation. And so, unfortunately for me, I was the I was one of the steady Eddies, because he viewed property as fairly steady Eddie, which is probably quite right. And then he was investing in some really interesting tech for his crazy, let's go for it, let's fly. And so we would meet up, and he'd lend me 600 grand every year. I'd buy two houses entirely with that money, refinance, pay him back out. And he'd be like, could you please hurry up and buy some more houses? So I would spend 100% of the funding on the houses. So I didn't have any bank funding when I was working with him. It was brilliant.
Amazing. Amazing. Susie, it's been fantastic to have this catch up with you. There's 100 or more questions I could ask you, but I think we should save those for another day, another episode. I'd like to say a massive thank you to you, though, for your time today, your frankness, your openness, your willingness to share your journey. It's an absolute pleasure to see you in very, very good health. You look amazing. From everything you've been through, you've really come through it, glowing, which is tremendous. And I really do hope that 2024 proves to be the year that you are going to make it, because I think everything that you've done so far paves the way for a fantastic 2024. And I think for anybody listening today, they will be inspired, they will be challenged, and they will be motivated to also make this a great year for them for investing in property.
Which will be
super. Thank you very much.
It'll be super exciting for them, won't it? Yes. And absolutely. Guys, you have got to go and see some videos of Wendy, because she's looking, I came on, didn't I? And I went, oh my goodness, you look like so young. So she's looking fabulous. And perhaps you might want to message her privately and ask her what her secret is, because she's, it could be those seven holidays, couldn't it? Well, life is looking wonderful. So I think it shows you that property is really worth doing, isn't it? Yeah,
definitely. Yeah. It is, for all sorts of reasons, all sorts of reasons.
Well, and good luck, everyone. And thank you so much.
We must get together. If not, I'm coming down to the Southwest.
Yes. For a meeting. Or Barcelona.
That's another option.
Yes.
Thanks, Susie.
Thank you for listening to the HMO Success Podcast. If you'd like to know more about how you can create a profitable HMO business, please visit our website, hmosuccess.co.uk, to find out more. We have plenty of free tools and information for you there, and also on our Facebook group, The Ultimate HMO Success System. We look forward to connecting with you very soon. Thanks for listening.